Hello and welcome to the World Resources Institute. Ahead of the COP28 climate change conference, what's on the agenda of climate vulnerable countries? What are their hopes, their ambitions, and their concerns?
We are not just concerned with the pledges. We want to see the actual action on the ground.
We need to have ambitious decisions on many aspects of climate action, but we need to have that paired with ambitious commitments on finance as well.
We'll be hearing from Colombia and Guyana about the global stocktake, loss and damage, finance, and the shift away from fossil fuels, and ask if vulnerable countries have any grounds for optimism as they head to COP28. Hello, this is the Big Ideas into Action podcast from the World Resources Institute. And in this episode, we're looking at the position of climate vulnerable countries ahead of the COP28 climate conference. One of the big issues these countries have been concerned about, loss and damage, was addressed at the last COP. But what's on their agenda this time around? We'll be talking to two members of the ACT 2025 grouping, a coalition amplifying the voices of vulnerable countries in the climate negotiations. Mark Bino of the Caribbean Community Climate Change Centre from Georgetown, Guyana, and Maria Laura Rojas of Transformer from Bogota, Colombia. Mark Bino first. What are the expectations at COP28 from climate vulnerable countries for the impact of the global stocktake, which assesses how far countries are making progress against their climate goals?
Well, quite frankly, I think the Paris Agreement's global stocktake is a unique opportunity to drive the global climate change and support and increase global cooperation and long-term climate goals. The vulnerable countries, I do believe, are looking for us to not only increase ambition, but also the scale and the depth with which these are likely to be enacted. It was designed to take place every 5 years. It aims to create evidence-based collective learning to inform future decisions and ramp up necessary climate action and support, both nationally and globally. But the global stocktake is specifically addressing progress with regard to the Paris Agreement, including on mitigation, adaptation, means of implementation, loss and damage. Now, this is done in three phases. We have the phase one, which is information collection and preparation, the technical assessment resulting in a synthesis report, and phase three, which is consideration of outputs resulting in a political declaration. For us, the vulnerable countries, we look at what is happening with regards to mitigation. And what we have seen is that on all fronts, yes, there have been some move towards reducing our emissions level. The question, however, is this at the scale and at the depth that would allow not only vulnerable countries to be able to breathe a bit easier, but to also align with the 1.5 degree pathway that will ensure a climate resilient future, right? So this underscores the urgency needed in action and support across all fronts of the climate agenda. The report also notes that there is both an ambition and an implementation gap in cutting greenhouse gas emissions, trajectories for which are not in line with modeling global mitigation pathways consistent with the temperature goal of the Paris Agreement. So looking forward, it addresses the need for systems transformations across all sectors and contexts, including scaling up renewable energy while phasing out all unabated fossil fuels, ending deforestation, reducing non-carbon dioxide emissions, and implementing both supply and demand side measures. It specifically highlights transformation in the energy sector, industry, transport, building, forestry, and agriculture, and the need for just transition, as well as the economic diversification to foster equity, inclusion, and to drive ambition. We do believe that as vulnerable countries, all of these are important elements. It's not only about the mitigation element, it's also about the adaptation and adaptation financing, that we are able to have adequate funding to be able to address our concerns and our needs. It must go a bit further than just looking at what it is we may need immediately and think more about long term. So you would have heard about the nature-based solutions to adaptation and how those are largely likely to be a lot more sustained than just going with the gray solutions. So we are focusing on adaptation as well. We spoke about means of implementation. And as a developing country, a coming from a vulnerable country, because Guyana is a low-lying coastal state whereby most of our people do live on the coast, it is a concern for us that the means of implementation, to be able to implement, you need the resources, you need the technology, you need the information, that these are being shared with us and at a pace that will allow us to thus be able to transition away from fossil fuel and into more renewables. And lastly, the issue on loss and damage. I do believe that setting out that framework was an adequate means by which we could thus be able to demonstrate and develop countries are able to pledge. But we are not just concerned with the pledges. We want to see the actual action on the ground, whereby we are able to determine that this is likely to be something that will help us quite outside and apart from adaptation in building our resiliency and thus insulating us against the impacts of climate change.
So turning to you, Maria Laura, COP27 saw a breakthrough on loss and damage, but details are still being hammered out. What's your assessment of where we are with all this?
Indeed, last year's agreement on the Loss and Damage Fund was and is a victory for climate justice for the Global South. Of course, it is the operationalization of the fund that will actually enable it to make a difference and have a positive impact for those in need. And that is why the work being done throughout the year by the Transitional Committee is so fundamental. Representatives from the developing world did not have as a primary option that the World Bank hosted the fund, but as in any negotiation, something had to be given. And the World Bank now has a very, very important role to play. From the perspective of the civil society, we hope that this decision takes into account the needs of all developing countries and of those most vulnerable, and that it ensures that direct access is one of the primary features of the fund. It is also very important that the fund is allowed to base its decision-making on climate-related needs. This sounds obvious, but we don't want to see a similar situation as we've seen in the Global Environmental Fund, or the GEF, where despite it being an environmental fund, political positionings from major shareholders have closed the doors of eligibility for certain developing countries that need the resources. From intel we have, countries are willing to agree to the agreed text and move forward. From our perspective, there is one outstanding issue, which is the lack of agreement on the baseline for the doubling of adaptation finance, let alone its implementation. This is, of course, one of the key priorities for developing countries. As Act 2025, we have previously called for this baseline to be OECD estimations of aggregate climate finance towards the 100 billion goal, which refers to the 2019 adaptation financing, which was around 20 billion. As a consequence, we are expecting that this baseline and numbers are agreed upon at COP28 so that developed countries top up their financial commitment to a total of 120 billion, which would reflect the fact that duplicating adaptation finance must come on top of existing mitigation funding. Finally, it seems that the EU and the US have offered to pledge contributions to this fund, and we do expect that developed countries and some other countries like the UAE can come forward with concrete pledges to capitalize the fund and actually make it operational soon enough.
Mark, you mentioned climate change a bit earlier. Where do you think we stand on the shift away from fossil fuels? What are the main challenges and things that you'll be watching out for?
Well, the shift from fossil fuel largely is going to be a process. It will not happen this year, but it's what we are driving at. I think the negotiators have asked for a 34% reduction by 2030, 68% reduction by 2040, and then a phasing out by 2050. But for me, I do believe taking a more pragmatic approach, we'll be looking to see what the big developed countries are moving towards. So, for example, are we going to see more new wells being opened up, like Prime Minister Sunak mentioned earlier this year? Are we going to see that the developed world, in the case of Germany and the United States, open up new areas? So These are all indications that we may be saying one thing but doing something else. And we are not concerned with what it is you are speaking to. We are concerned with what you're actually doing. And so the phasing out or the phasing down of fossil fuel has to be a process. But at the same time, I need to add this caveat. There are some developing countries that have recently discovered fossil fuel, and they are now in a position to either exploit that very rapidly or be held with stranded resources. The question then becomes, how can they justifiably transition to more renewables? Because the IMF report quoted that $7 trillion are going to the fossil fuel industry, and this is just in 2022, to help them to continue to exploit. And we are asking, can we have just a portion of that going towards the renewable energy sector? Because renewable energy is still lagging significantly behind where fossil fuels are, and we need to be able to catch up. And thus, the idea is, let us seek means and avenues via which we are able to do this.
On climate finance, are we at last seeing signs that money that's been promised is finally on its way?
We do have a recent report by the OECD on climate finance provided and mobilized that indicates preliminarily and not yet verified that the goal could be reached. So this does bring some hope, but not entirely. On the one hand, climate finance is and will continue to be one of the most important catalyzers of action and trust as part of the process. On the other hand, it is overdue and yet to be verified. Other key elements of climate finance in the regime are still to be discussed and agreed as well. In this COP, finance is embedded into the most important negotiation items. This includes the global stocktake, loss and damage, and how to finance the just energy transitions globally and particularly in developing countries. So this OECD report gives that sign, but it is important that we see clear and transparent demonstrations that this is actually happening. One of them would be to have an unequivocally larger second replenishment of the Green Climate Fund, including generous contributions by countries such as the US. In the same line of thought, we are getting to a point in which developing countries are mostly accessing climate finance by continuously increasing their levels of indebtedness. And this is in a context of very constrained fiscal space for many other reasons of geopolitical context and the state of the economy worldwide. So we call for solidarity with the developing world in broadening the range of financial instruments available that are either grant-based or that do not create further debt, particularly for adaptation and loss and damage. The OECD report shows an overall increment in climate finance towards the 100 billion. But quality issues are also important to be discussed. For example, finance available for adaptation decreased from 28.6 billion in 2020 to 24.6 billion in 2021, and loans continue to be the main instrument to provide finance to developing countries. It really is our hope that these considerations permeate deliberations over the new goal of finance, and that this year's COP sets the basis for an ambitious goal that helps us transform the financial system to deliver on a just transition to 1.5.
Just one final question. Heading into COP28, are you optimistic that some progress is being made?
Yes, I am, because I don't think it is by accident that you have it in Abu Dhabi, which is one of the major oil producers, but also there have been a lot of pressure, a lot of talk, and as a result, I do believe the Saudis would want to come out of this COP showing that they have been able to deliver. Now, I don't want to put my expectations level too high, but I do expect we will move along the continuum and there will be some positive responses that we will see that will help us to address and seek to abate the issue with climate change.
A dear colleague of mine said yesterday that she was cautiously optimistic, which I will quote from her. I think that there are many conditions for this COP to be a success, and there are many that make it very, very challenging. What I think will be most important in this COP is that developing country needs are reflected in the decisions. We need to have ambitious decisions on many aspects of climate action, but we need to have that paired with ambitious commitments on finance as well, so that developing countries can have the support that they need to implement the action that we all need collectively and globally.
That was Maria Laura Rojas of Transformer. And before her, you heard Mark Bino of the Caribbean Community Climate Change Centre giving their takes on the forthcoming COP28 conference. Both are members of the ACT 2025 grouping, a coalition amplifying the voices of vulnerable countries in the climate negotiations. And you can find out more by searching for ACT 2025 on our website, wri.org. You can also find more podcasts about the climate, loss and damage, and many, many other issues by going to wri.org/podcasts or by subscribing. I'm Nicholas Walton, and that's all for now. Goodbye.